This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Hi, it's midnight. My name is Anne-Marie Hendrickson, and this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Pentangle.
As I walk up to Morgan, each day I could hear them cry.
Good evening. Tonight is going to be a show of some music and some stories. And that was, we started out with the music. That was Pentangle, Market Song from Sweet Child, which I'm sure we're going to be hearing from more as the evening goes by. And the stories tonight all have kind of a unified theme of, well, communication, I guess you could say. Communication and in some cases magic in places where you wouldn't expect to find it. And the first couple of stories I'm going to read are from a novel that is a favorite of mine, which is Crystal Vision by Gilbert Sorrentino. And the setup for this is just that it's a series of short chapters. Each one of them involves a bunch of mooks standing in front of a candy store in Brooklyn in the 1940s. And, you know, they just talk about the kind of things that guys talk about in front of a candy store in Brooklyn. But in each case, their story kind of illustrates one of the cards in the tarot. And, well, I'll read two of the stories and you can judge for yourself which cards in the tarot it is illustrating. La Vida es Sueño. Let me tell you about this dream, Irish Billy says. One of the goddamnedest things. I dislike dreams, the Arab says, my own included. Not only are they wanted to bore you to pieces and filled chock to the brim with non-segures, they are the cause of ennui, psychiatrically speaking, instead. Besides, why should I desire to listen to your dream? I can bore myself by repeating to myself my own dreams. Oh, it's not my dream, Billy says. This is a dream Richie had, and he told me about it. It's really a hell of a dream. If you insist, the Arab says, looking over at the drummer. It's either that or a tramping trek through the snow. Okay, Richie, you know, he hasn't seen his father in years, 10 or 15 or maybe even more years. So in the dream, he decides to go down to Florida where the old man lives in the dream for a visit. In the dream, he's married. His wife don't look like her, but his wife is Cookie. You know how these things happen in a dream? Freud has explained it all with grave candidness, the Arab says. But Cookie, oh my, my. Anyway, Richie and Cookie drive down in a pink Nash. They get there in like a second, and the dream Florida is just a big flat plain all brown with a few dead trees here and there, with Spanish moss draped off them, even though Richie told me he knows that this stuff only grows on trees in Louisiana. Spanish moss. Oh, a nice touch, an excellent touch. I didn't think Richie possessed this genre of subtleness in his brain. Once in a while, they see an orange tree or a lemon tree, but mostly the goddamn place looks like a big, vacant lot. Just then, cutting across the plain towards them comes a maroon caddy, and the guy driving it turns out to be Richie's brother, and of course, he hasn't got a brother. Richie hasn't got any brothers, the drummer says. I just said that, but in the dream, he's got at least this one guy who's his brother, and he's in this maroon caddy. So Richie follows this guy to a big white house with flowers and palm trees and a huge fountain. And in the front lawn, there's a marble gnomon. A marble what? The Arab says, taking a step towards Billy. A gnomon, a sundial, right on the lawn, all marble. Gnomon, gnomon, delicious. Richie, by God, is beginning to glow, even may I impute to glitter in my book. Gnomon, gnomon. Wonderful. They go around in the back of the house and pass a woman with two kids who is definitely Richie's brother's wife, Richie's sister-in-law. She smiles at Richie and pushes the two kids kind of like toward him, but he's like rushing order after his brother to get to the back. And then he sees his father in the middle of a patio made out of different colored flagstones sitting in a little greenhouse. What do they call those little houses, Arab? The Arab shuffles and looks at the drummer, embarrassed. I'm afraid, he says, the word has exited from my mind. To use an old cliche, it's on the tip of my tongue, but I can't. Gazebo, Billy says. Right. His old man is sitting in a little, like, gazebo. Of course, the Arab says. Of course, a gazebo. How dullardly of me to have forgotten such a common household term. A gorgeous word. The gazebo has a blue cloth draped on four corner poles instead of a roof to keep off the sun. Bright blue like the sky and spangled with stars. Spangled with stars. My goodness, drummer, this young man can only mosaically use such words as gazebo. He can also turn a handsome phrase. Excellent. There is his father in the gazebo wearing a blue robe, the same color as the cloth. In front of the gazebo are two stone sphinxes, one black and one white. As Richie comes up to him behind his brother, his father stands up. He doesn't even see Richie. He says, I'm leaving. I'm going to New York to see my son. Make reservations for me while I get started right now. Richie yells, wait, wait, I'm your son. I'm right here. I'm not in New York. But his father is gone. He looks around and his wife is gone and so is the Nash. He sees his brother driving away in the caddy, and just then his sister-in-law comes up, only now she's his wife, who is Cookie, right? And she says that she'd like the kids to meet their nice Uncle Richie, okay? Richie says no. He wants to go catch his father, and his sister-in-law says how come he's in Florida, because his father doesn't live in Florida. Who the hell would live in Florida, she says. And that's the dream. This is the dream, the Arab says. This? Where's the story? Where's the drama? Where's the denouement? Where's the morality? That's the dream. I have a rotten and putrid feeling that Richie made up this dream so that he could say gnomon and gazebo and spangled. That's the stinky and ingenerous feeling that is cascading through me. Drummer? My feeling is equally rotten and putrid about this dream. That's baloney, Irish Billy says. I used the words, not Richie. You parroted and aped and mimicried the words, you mean, the Arab says. No, they're my words. I thought I'd try them out for real, talking, you know, like now. And this is also your dream, the Arab says, your phony dream. No, it's Richie's dream, and Richie really actually went down to Florida anyway. I mean, he actually went down to Florida to visit his father, and he found out that he's got a brother who hasn't got a caddy, but he has got a Nash, only it's brown, not pink. And the morning he got there, his father just left to go on a business trip to New York. Now, is that a fantastic thing, or is that a fantastic thing? A fantastic dream. The whole dream thing. This trip Richie made, the Arab says, I must crudely and grossly enunciate that it is a pile of BS, that it did not happen. It might have happened, Billy says. And the dream didn't happen either. Spangled, gnomon, for shame, gazebo, shame, shame. Might have happened, too. How about the Spanish moss, the drummer says, Arab. How about the Spanish moss? Arab, the Spanish? Spanish moss, shame, shame. Crushing prevarications. The next chapter. I know it's hard to impress upon you gentlemen the idea of a perfect pastoral scene, Professor Kuba says. I call that snobbery, Professor, the drummer says. Some of us are sensitive enough to understand the finer things, nature, trees, lakes in the misty mountains, cows, you name it. Peace, Professor Kuba says. Permit me to apologize. I amend my statement to read, some of you, gentlemen. We don't need any perfect pastoral scenes, Irish Billy says. Perfect pastoral scenes, and what do you mean, read? The country, as you think of it, Kuba, Doc Friday says, is no more than a clerk's idea. It has no relation to reality. Billy is correct. As a matter of fact, I feel that the very word pastoral has no basis in what is actually out there. Nevertheless, Professor Kuba says, assume that there may be a perfect pastoral scene. Within this scene, allow me to place one of our old acquaintances, Cookie Lenord, nay, Cookie, what's her name? We all know the Cookie you mean, Irish Billy says. And perfect pastoral scene or not, there is no possibility of Cookie ever being in it, or part of it, or in any way, shape, or manner whatsoever. So help me God, Sailor says. This must be Kuba's annual flirtation with surrealism, Doc Friday says. No wonder he's currently broke. No wonder we're all currently broke, Cheech says. Instead of working, here we are in the goddamn corner talking about Cookie in the country. Jesus. Pay no mind to Cheech, Kuba says. He's the guy who was afraid to go home from the Royale one night after someone told him a spooky story about the gypsy's hand. Baloney, Cheech says, but he blushes. I remember the evening well, the drummer says. He even forgot to eat his bow tie and his coffee got cold. It was a Mae West, you dumb bastard. Gentlemen, gentlemen, Kuba says. Go on, Kuba, the sailor says. We got nothing to do. And you don't talk, the drummer will tell us about his dog act in vaudeville, when vaudeville was vaudeville. Professor Kuba leans against a car, and crosses his arms. I had no idea, he says, that the smallest whisper of a hint about the pastoral would cause such a scene, such a hubbub. Start again, Professor, Irish Billy says. The sailor's right. A damp, soft wind touched with a delicate aroma of salt and fish blows up from the narrows. A pastoral scene, Kuba says. Mountains in the background. Trees, black specks in a faraway pasture that we might as well call cows, you know, the usual claptrap. But in the foreground, in a long, white, flowing dress, there is a young woman whose face, as they say, is familiar. she looks like, and she probably is, Cookie Lenord, Cookie of the Carnival, Cookie of the G-string and panties, of the black net stockings and the high heels, Cookie Lenord, whose fame in being frozen alive in a giant block of ice has spread her name far and wide among all the world types in Christendom, and even in places so far flung in Indiana, regardless of their race, creed, or previous jobs. Observe her. In her long white dress, she looks like a virgin, but we all know that she lost her cherry right down the street in the park when she was just a slip of a lass of 13. Her face is serene. Around her waist is a chain of flowers. God only knows what kind, and at the other end of the chain there is a gigantic and ferocious lion. Cookie is slowly but surely closing up his slobbering maw. The sun beams down on old Montana, and around her head busy bees hum, buzzing in a figure eight. And? Doc Friday asks. And? Kubo replies. And? Gentlemen, what, I ask you, do you make of this scene? That is the pressing question. Why is the notorious Cookie, once in a while referred to as Cookie Lagash, engaged in this oddball and thoroughly goofy act, yet one that is bursting with overtones of the peaceful, the pastoral, the all-around country-ish? Can she maybe be out at the carny owner's place in the country for a weekend of fun and meanwhile breaking in a new act with Animal, the drummer says? Precisely, Professor Kuba says. Exactly and precisely and bravo. And now from there I'm going to move on to some stories from a different source, but which I think are stories that story kind of drew on. These are old traditional European folk tales, and I'm reading them from Andrew Lang's Green Fairy Book, and they all have kind of a unified theme. And let's see if you can, I'm sure you'll figure out quickly enough what it is. The Three Snake Leaves. There was once a poor man who could no longer afford to keep his only son at home. So the son said to him, "Dear father, you are so poor that I am only a burden to you. I would rather go out into the world and see if I can earn my own living." The father gave him his blessing and took leave of him with much sorrow. About this time, the king of a very powerful kingdom was carrying on a war. The youth, therefore, took service under him and went on the campaign. When they came before the enemy, a battle took place, and there was some hot fighting, and it rained bullets so quickly that his comrades fell about him on all sides. And when the leader fell to, the rest wished to take flight. But the youth stepped forward and encouraged them and called out, "We must not let our country be ruined." Then others followed him, and he pressed on and defeated the enemy. When the king heard that he had to thank him alone for the victory, he raised him higher than anyone in rank, gave him great treasures, and made him the first in the kingdom. The king had a daughter who was very beautiful, but she was also very capricious. She had made a vow to marry no one who would not promise her that if she died first, he would allow himself to be buried alive with her. "If he loved me truly," she used to say, "what use would life be to him without me? At the same time, she was willing to do the same, and if he died first, to be buried with him. This curious vow had up to this time frightened away all possible suitors, but the young man was so captivated by her beauty that he hesitated at nothing and asked her hand of his father. Asked her hand of her father, excuse me. "Do you know," asked the king, "what you have to promise?" "I shall have to go into her grave with her," he answered, "if I outlive her, but my love is so great that I do not think of the risk." So the king consented, and the wedding was celebrated with great splendor. Now, they lived for a long time very happily with one another. But then it came to pass that the young queen fell seriously ill, and no doctor could save her. And when she lay dead, the young king remembered what he had promised, and made him shudder to think of lying in her grave alive, but there was no escape. The king had set guards before all the gates, and it was not possible to avoid his fate. When the day arrived on which the corpse was to be laid in the royal vault, he was laid thither. Then the entrance was bolted and closed up. Now, near the coffin stood a table, on which were placed four candles, four loaves of bread, and four bottles of wine. As soon as this provision came to an end, he would have to die. So he sat there full of grief and misery, eating every day only a tiny bit of bread and drinking only a mouthful of wine, and he watched death creeping nearer and nearer to him. One day, as he was sitting, staring moodily in front of him, he saw a snake creep out of the corner towards the corpse. Thinking it was going to touch it, he drew his sword and said, "As long as I am alive, you shall not harm her." And he cut it into three pieces. After a little time, a second snake crept out of the corner. But when it saw the first one lying dead and in pieces, it went back and came back again, holding three green leaves in its mouth. Then it took the three bits of the snake and laid them in order and put one of the leaves on each wound. Immediately the pieces joined together, the snake moved itself and became alive, and then both hurried away. The leaves remained lying on the ground, and it suddenly occurred to the unfortunate man who had seen everything that the wonderful power of the leaves might also be exercised upon a human being. So he picked up the leaves and laid one of them on the mouth and the other two on the eyes of the dead woman. And scarcely had he done this before the blood began to circulate in her veins, then it mounted and brought color back to her white face. Then she drew her breath, opened her eyes, and said, "Ah, where am I?" "You're with me, dear lady," he answered, and told her all that had happened, and how he had brought her to life again. He then gave her some wine and bread, and when all her strength had returned, she got up, and they went to the door, and knocked and called so loudly that the guards heard them and told the king. The king came himself to open the door, and then he found both happy and well, and he joined with them, now that all trouble was over. But the young king gave the three snake leaves to a servant, saying to him, Keep them carefully for me, and always carry them with you. Who knows but that they may help us in a time of need?" It seemed, however, as if a change had come over the young queen after she had been restored to life, and as if all her love for her husband had faded from her heart. Sometime afterwards, when he wanted to take a journey over to the sea to see his old father, and they were on board the ship, she forgot the great love and faithfulness that he had shown her, and how he had saved her from death, and she fell in love with the captain. And one day when the young king was lying asleep, she called the captain to her, and seized the head of the sleeping king, and made him take his feet, and together they threw him into the sea. When they had done this wicked deed, she said to him, "Now let us go home and say that he has died on the journey. I will praise you so much to my father that he will marry me to you and make you the heir to the throne." But the faithful servant who had seen everything let down a little boat into the sea, unobserved by them, and rowed after his master while the traitor sailed on. He took the drowned man out of the water, and with the help of the three snake leaves which he carried with him, placed them on his mouth and eyes, and he brought him back to life again. They both rowed as hard as they could, both night and day, and their little boat went so quickly that they reached the old king before the other two did. He was much astonished to see them back alone, and he asked what had happened to them. When he heard the wickedness of his daughter, he said, "I cannot believe that she acted so wrongly, but the truth will soon come to light." He made them both go into a secret chamber and let no one see them. Soon after this, the large ship came in, and the wicked lady appeared before her father very sad and low. He said to her, "Why have you come back alone? Where is your husband?" "Ah, dear father," she replied, "I have come home in great grief. My husband fell ill on the voyage quite suddenly and died. And if the good captain had not given me help, I should have died as well. He was at his deathbed, and he can tell you everything." The king said, "I will bring the dead back to life again." And he opened the door of the room and called them both out. The lady was as if thunderstruck when she caught sight of her husband. She fell on her knees and begged for mercy. But the king said, "You shall have no mercy. He was ready to die with you and restored you to life again. But you killed him when he was sleeping and shall receive your deserts." So she and her accomplice were put in a ship which was bored through with holes and was drawn out into the sea, where they soon perished in the waves. And that's a story from Grimm. The next story is called The Enchanted Snake. There was once upon a time a poor woman who would have given away all she possessed for a child, but she hadn't one. Now it happened one day that her husband went to the wood to gather brushwood, and when he had brought it home, he discovered a pretty little snake in among the twigs. When Sabatella, for that was the name of the peasant's wife, saw the little beast, she sighed deeply and said, "Even the snakes have their brood. I alone am unfortunate and have no children." No sooner had she said these words But to her tense surprise, the little snake looked up into her face and spoke. "Since you have no children, be a mother to me instead, and I promise you will never repent it, for I will love you as if I were your own son." At first, Sabatella was frightened to death at hearing a snake speak, but plucking up her courage, she replied, "If it weren't for any other reason than your kindly thought, I would agree to what you say, and I will love you and look after you like a mother." So she gave the snake a little hole in the house for its bed, fed it with all the nicest food that she could think of, and seemed as if she could never show it enough kindness. Day by day it grew bigger and fatter, and at last one morning it said to Matteo, the peasant, whom it had always regarded as the father, "Dear Papa, I am now of a suitable age, and I would wish to marry." "I'm quite agreeable," said Matteo. "I'll do my best to find another snake like yourself and arrange a match between you." "Why, if you do that," said the snake, "we should be no better than the vipers and the reptiles, and that's not what I want at all. No, I'd much prefer to marry the king's daughter. Therefore, I pray you go without further delay and demand an audience of the king and tell him a snake wishes to marry his daughter." Matteo, who was rather a simpleton, went as he was desired to see the king, and having obtained an audience, he said, "Your Majesty, I have often heard that people lose nothing by asking, so I have come to inform you that a snake wants to marry your daughter, and I'll be glad to know if you are willing to marry a dove with a serpent." The king, who saw at once that the man was a fool, said, in order to get rid of him, "Go home and tell your friend the snake that if he can turn this palace into ivory inlaid with gold and silver before tomorrow at noon, I will let him marry my daughter." And with a hearty laugh, he dismissed the peasant. When Matteo brought this answer back to the snake, the little creature didn't seem the least put out and said, "Tomorrow morning before sunrise, you must go to the wood and gather a bunch of green herbs and then rub the threshold of the palace with them, and then you'll see what will happen." Matteo, who was, as I have said before, a great simpleton, made no reply, but before sunrise next morning he went to the wood and gathered a bunch of St. John's wort and rosemary and such like herbs and rubbed them, as he had been told, on the floor of the palace. Hardly had he done so when the walls immediately turned into ivory, so richly inlaid with gold and silver that they dazzled the eyes of all beholders. The king, when he rose and saw the miracle that had been performed, was beside himself with amazement, and he didn't know what in the world he was to do. But when Matteo came the next day, and in the name of the snake, demanded the hand of the princess, the king replied, "Don't be in such a hurry. If the snake really wants to marry my daughter, he must do some more things first, and one of these is to turn all the paths on the walls of my garden into pure gold before noon tomorrow." When the snake was told of this new condition, he replied, "Tomorrow morning, early, you must go and collect all the odds and ends of rubbish you can find on the streets, and then take them and throw them on the paths and walls of the garden, and you'll see then if we don't make something that is more than a match from the old king." So Matteo rose at cockcrow, took a large basket under his arm, and carefully collected all the broken fragments of pots and pans and jugs and lamps and other trash of that sort. No sooner had he scattered them over the paths and walls of the king's garden than they became one blaze of glittering gold, so that everyone's eyes were dazzled with the brilliancy, and everyone's soul was filled with wonder. The king, too, was amazed at the sight, but still he couldn't make up his mind to part with his daughter, no matter, so that when Matteo came to remind him of his promise, he replied, "I have still a third demand to make. If the snake can turn all the trees and fruit of my garden into precious stones, then I promise him my daughter in marriage." When the peasant informed the snake what the king had said, he replied, "Tomorrow morning, early, you must go to the market and buy all the fruit you see there, and then sow all the stones and seeds in the palace garden, and if I'm not mistaken, the king will be satisfied with the results." Matteo rose at dawn, and taking a basket in his arm, he went to the market and bought all the pomegranates, apricots, cherries, and other fruit that he could find there, and then he sowed the seeds and stones in the palace garden. In one moment the trees were all ablaze with rubies, emeralds, diamonds, and every other precious stone that you can think of. This time the king felt obliged to keep his promise, and calling his daughter to him, he said, "My dear Grammonia," for that was the daughter's name, "more as a joke than anything else, I demanded what seemed to me impossibilities from your bridegroom, but now he has done all that I required, and I am bound to stick to my part of the bargain. Be a good child, and as you love me, do not force me to break my word, but give yourself up with as good grace as you can to a most unhappy state. Do with me what you like, my lord and father, for your will is my law. answered Grimonia. When the king heard this, he told Matteo to bring the snake to the palace and said that he was prepared to receive the creature as his son-in-law. The snake arrived at court in a carriage made of gold and drawn by 6 white elephants. But wherever it appeared on the way, the people fled in terror at the sight of the fearful reptile. When the snake reached the palace, all the courtiers shook and trembled with fear down to the very scullion, and the king and queen were in such a state of nervous collapse that they hid themselves in a faraway turret. Grimonia alone kept her presence of mind, and although both her father and her mother implored her to fly for her life, she wouldn't move a step, saying, "I'm certainly not going to fly from the man that you have chosen for my husband." As soon as the snake saw Grimonia, it wound its tail around her and kissed her. Then, leading her into a room, it shut the door, and throwing off its skin, it changed into a beautiful young man with golden locks and flashing eyes who embraced Grimonia tenderly and said all kinds of pretty things to her. When the king saw the snake shut itself into a room with his daughter, he said to his wife, "Heaven be merciful to our child, for I fear it is all over with her now. This cursed snake will most likely have swallowed her up." Then they put their eyes through the keyhole to see what had happened. Their amazement knew no bounds when they saw a beautiful youth standing before their daughter with the snake's skin lying on the floor beside him. In their excitement, they burst open the door, and seizing the skin, they threw it into the fire. But no sooner had they done this than the young man called out, "Oh, wretched people, what have you done?" And before they had time to look around, he had changed himself into a dove, and dashing against the window, he broke a pane of glass and flew away out of their sight. But Grimonia, who in one and the same moment saw herself merry and sad, cheerful and despairing, rich and beggared, complained bitterly over the robbery of her happiness, the poisoning of her cup of joy, this unlucky stroke of fortune, and laid all of the blame on her parents, though they assured her that they had meant no harm. But the princess refused to be comforted, and at night, when all the inhabitants of the palace were asleep, she stole out by a back door, disguised herself as a peasant woman, determined to seek for her lost happiness until she found it. When she got to the outskirts of the town, led by the light of the moon, she met a fox, who offered to accompany her, an offer which Grimonia gladly accepted, saying, "You are most heartily welcome, for I don't know my way at all around the neighborhood." So they went on their way together, and came at last to a wood, where, being tired with walking, they paused to rest under the shade of a tree, where a spring of water sported with the tender grass, refreshing it with its crystal spray. They laid themselves down upon the green carpet and soon fell fast asleep, and did not waken again until the sun was high in the heavens. They rose up and stood for some time listening to the birds singing, because Grimonia delighted in their songs. When the fox perceived this, he said, "If you only understood, as I do, what these little birds are saying, your pleasure would be even greater." Provoked by his words, for we all know that curiosity is as deeply inborn in every woman as even the love of talking, Grimonia implored the fox to tell her what the birds had said. At first the wily fox refused to tell her what he had gathered from the conversation of the birds, but at last he gave way to her entreaties and told her that they had spoken of the misfortunes of a beautiful young prince, whom a wicked enchantress had turned into a snake for a period of 7 years. At the end of this time he had fallen in love with a charming princess, but that when he had shut himself up into a room with her and had thrown off his snake skin, her parents had forced their way into the room and had burnt the skin, whereupon the prince, changed into the likeness of a dove, had broken a pane of glass in trying to fly out of the window, and had wounded himself so badly that the doctors despaired of his life. Grimonia, when she learned that they were talking of her lover, asked at once whose son he was, and if there was any hope of his recovery, to which the fox made answer that the birds had said that he was the son of the king of Valona Grosso, and that the only thing that could cure him was to rub the wounds on his head with the blood of the very birds who had told the tale. Then Grimonia knelt down before the fox, and begged him in her sweetest way to catch the birds for her and procure their blood, promising at the same time to reward him richly. "All right," said the fox, "only don't be in such a hurry. Let's wait till night when the little birds have gone to roost, and then I'll climb up and catch them all for you." So they passed the day, talking now of the beauty of the prince, now of the father of the princess, and then of the misfortune that had happened. At last the night arrived, and all the little birds were asleep high up in the branches of a big tree. The fox climbed up stealthily and caught the little creatures with his paws one after the other, And when he had killed them all, he put their blood into a little bottle which he wore at his side, and returned with it to Grandmonia, who was beside herself with joy as at the result of the fox's raid. But the fox said, "My dear daughter, your joy is in vain, because, let me tell you, this blood is of no earthly use to you unless you add some of mine to it." And with these words he took to his heels. Grandmonia, who saw her hopes dashed to the ground in this cruel way, had recourse to flattery and cunning, weapons which have often stood her sex in good stead, and she called out after the fox, "Father Fox, you would be quite right to save your skin if, in the first place, I didn't feel that I owed so much to you, and if, in the second, that there weren't other foxes in the world. But, as you know how grateful I feel to you, and as there are heaps of other foxes about, you can trust yourself to me. Don't behave like the cow that kicks the pail over after it has filled it with milk, but continue your journey with me, and when we get to the capital, you can sell me to the king as a servant girl." It never entered the fox's head that even foxes can be outwitted, and after a bit he consented to go with her. But he hadn't gone before the cunning girl seized a stick and gave him such a blow with it on the head that he dropped down dead on the spot. Then Grandmonia took some of his blood and poured it into her little bottle, and went on her way as fast as she could to Valone Grosso. When she arrived there, she went straight to the royal palace and let the king be told that she had come to cure the young prince. The king commanded her to be brought before him at once, and was much astonished when he saw that it was a girl who understood to do what all the cleverest doctors of his kingdom had failed to do. As an attempt hurts no one, he willingly consented that she should do what she could. "All I ask," said Grandmonia, "is that I should succeed in what you desire. If I should succeed in what I desire, you will give me your son in marriage." The king, who had given up all hopes of his son's recovery, replied, "Only restore him to life and to health, and he shall be yours. It is only fair to give her a husband who gives me a son." And so they went into the prince's room. The moment Grandmonia had rubbed the blood on his wounds, the illness left him, and he was as sound and as well as ever. When the king saw his son thus marvelously restored to life and to health, he turned to him and said, "My dearest son, I thought of you as dead, and now, to my great joy and amazement, you are alive again. I promised this young woman that if she should cure you, I would bestow your hand and heart to her, and seeing that heaven has been gracious, you must fulfill the promise that I made to her, for gratitude alone forces me to pay this debt." But the prince answered, "My lord and father, I would that my will were as free as my love for you is great. But as I have plighted my word to another maiden, you will see yourself, and so will this young woman, that I cannot go back from my word and be faithless to her whom I love." Grandmonia heard these words and saw how deeply rooted the prince's love for her was. She felt very happy, and blushing rosy red, she said, "But should I get the other lady to give up her rights, would you then consent to marry me?" "Far be it from me," replied the prince, "to banish the beautiful picture of my love from my heart. Whatever she may say, my heart and desire will remain the same, and though I were to lose my life for it, I couldn't consent to this marriage." Grandmonia couldn't keep silence any longer, and throwing off her peasant's disguise, she discovered herself to the prince, who was nearly beside himself with joy when he recognized his fair lady love. He then told his father at once who she was, and what she had done and suffered for his sake. Then they invited the king and queen of Sarsalonga to their court, and had a great wedding feast, and proved once more that there is no better seasoning for the joys of true love than a few pangs of grief. That story is based on a traditional Neapolitan story, a more of a folk story, but that version of it is from a collection of stories by Giambattista Bassila. And, you know, like he's like Charles Perrault or someone like that. That's more of a, he's a 17th century courtly writer, and that's a more literary folktale. And the last story I'm going to read from this collection is called The White Snake. And this is probably my favorite. This is the one that made the biggest impression on me as a child. This is a story from this is a folk story collected by the Brothers Grimm. Not very long ago, there lived a king, the fame of whose wisdom was spread far and wide. Nothing appeared to be unknown to him, and it really seemed as if the tidings of the most secret matters must be borne to him by the winds. He had one very peculiar habit. Every day, After the dinner table had been cleared and everyone had retired, a confidential servant brought in a dish. It was covered, and neither the servant nor anyone else had any idea what was in it, for the king never removed the cover or partook of the dish until he was quite alone. This went on for some time until one day the servant who removed the dish was so overcome with curiosity that he could not resist carrying it off to his own room. After carefully locking the door, he lifted the cover, and there he saw a white snake lying on the dish. On seeing it, he could not restrain his desire to taste it, and so he cut off a small piece and put it into his mouth. Hardly had it touched his tongue than he heard a strange sort of whispering of tiny voices around his window. He stepped to the casement to listen and found that the sound proceeded from the sparrows, who were talking together and telling each other all that they had seen in the fields and the woods. The piece of the white snake which he had eaten had enabled him to understand the language of animals. Now, on this particular day, it so happened that the queen lost her favorite ring, and suspicion fell on the confidential servant who had access to all parts of the palace. The king sent for him and threatened him angrily, saying that if he had not found the thief by the next day, that he himself should be taken up and tried. It was useless to assert his innocence. He was dismissed forthwith without ceremony. In his agitation and distress, he went down to the yard to think over what he could do in this trouble. Here he found a number of ducks resting near a little stream and pluming themselves with their bills, whilst they kept up an animated conversation amongst themselves. The servants stood still and listened to them. They were talking of where they had been waddling about all the morning and of all the good food they had found. But one of them remarked rather sadly, "There's something lying very heavy on my stomach, for in my haste I've swallowed a ring which was lying just under the queen's window." No sooner did the servant hear this than he seized the duck by the neck, carried it off to the kitchen, and said to the cook, "Suppose you kill this duck. You see that she's nice and fat." "Yes, indeed," said the cook, weighing the duck in his hand. "She certainly has spared no pains to stuff herself well, and must have been waiting for the spit for some time." So he chopped off her head, and when she was opened, there was the queen's ring in her stomach. It was easy enough now for the servant to prove his innocence, and the king, feeling he had done him an injustice, was anxious to make some amends, and desired him to ask any favor he chose, and promised to give him the highest post at court that he could wish for. The servant, however, declined everything and only begged for a horse and some money to enable him to travel, as he was anxious to see something of the world. When his request was granted, he set off on his journey, and in the course of it one day he came to a large pond on the edge of which he spied three fishes which had got entangled in the reeds and were gasping for water. Though fish are generally supposed to be quite mute, he heard them grieving aloud at the prospect of dying in this wretched manner. Having a very kind heart, he dismounted and soon set the prisoners free, and he put them in the water once more. They flapped with joy, and stretching up their heads, cried to him, "We will remember and reward you for saving us." He rowed further, and after a while he thought he heard a voice in the sand under his feet. He paused to listen, and heard the king of the ants complaining, "If only men with their awkward beasts would keep clear of us. That stupid horse is crushing my people mercilessly to death with his great hoofs." The servant at once turned onto a side path, and the ant king called after him, "We'll remember and reward you." The road next led through a wood, where he saw a father and a mother raven standing by their nest and throwing out their young. "Away with you, you young rascals," they cried. "We can't feed you any longer. You are quite big enough to support yourselves now." The poor little birds lay on the ground, flapping and beating their wings, and shrieked, "We poor helpless children feed ourselves indeed. Why, we can't even fly yet. Why, what can we do but die of hunger?" Then the kind youth dismounted, drew his sword, and killed his horse, and left it there as food for the young ravens. They hopped up, satisfied their hunger, and piped, "We'll remember you and reward you." He was now obliged to trust to his own legs, and after walking a long way, he reached a big town. Here he found a great crowd and much commotion in the streets, and a herald rode about announcing, "The king's daughter seeks a husband, but whoever would woo her must first execute a difficult task, and if he does not succeed, he must be content to forfeit his life." Many had risked their lives, but in vain. When the youth saw the king's daughter, he was so dazzled by her beauty that he forgot all idea of danger and went to the king to announce himself as a suitor. On this, he was led out to a large lake, and a gold ring was thrown into it before his eyes. The king desired him to dive after it, adding, If you return without it, you will be thrown back into the lake time after time till you are drowned in the depths. Everyone felt sorry for the handsome young fellow and left him alone on the shore. There he stood thinking and wondering what he could do, when all of a sudden he saw three fishes swimming along and recognized them as the very same whose lives he had saved. The middle fish held a mussel in his mouth, which he laid at the young man's feet, and when he picked it up and opened it, there was the golden ring inside. Full of delight, he brought it to the king's daughter, expecting to now receive his promised reward. The haughty princess, however, on hearing that he was not her equal by birth, despised him, and exacted the fulfillment of a second task. She went into the garden, and with her own hands she strewed 10 sacks full of millet all over the garden. "He must pick all that up tomorrow morning before sunrise," she said, "and not a grain must be lost." The youth sat down in the garden and wondered how it would be possible for him to accomplish the task, but he could think of no expedient, and sat there sadly, expecting to meet his death at daybreak. But when the first rays of the rising sun fell on the garden, he saw that the 10 sacks were all completely filled, standing there in a row, and not a single grain was missing. The ant king, with his thousands and thousands of followers, had come during the night, and the grateful creatures had industriously gathered all the millet together and put it into the sacks. The king's daughter came down to the garden herself and saw to her amazement that her suitor had accomplished the task that she had given him. Even now she could not bend her proud heart, and she said, "Though he has executed those 2 tasks, yet he shall not be my husband till he brings to me an apple from the tree of life." The young man did not even know where the tree of life grew, but he set off, determined to walk as far as his legs would carry them, though he had no hope of ever finding it. After journeying through three different kingdoms, he reached a wood one night and, lying down under a tree, prepared to go to sleep there. Suddenly, he heard a sound in the boughs, and a golden apple fell right into his hand. At the same moment, 3 ravens flew down to him, perched on his knee, and said, "We are the 3 young ravens whom you saved from starvation. When we grew up and heard that you were searching for the golden apple, we flew away over the seas until the end of the world, where the tree of life grows, and we fetched the golden apple for you." Full of joy, the young man started on his way back and brought the golden apple to the lovely princess, whose objections were now entirely silenced. They divided the apple of life and ate it together, and her heart softened and grew full of love for him, so that they lived together to a great age in undisturbed happiness. And that is the end of the stories from that book.
Queen Eleanor was a sick woman, and the sick just like to die. And she has sent 40 friars of France to come to speedily. The king has called his nobles all by one, by two, by three. Earl Marshal, I'll go shrive the queen, and thou should wend with me. Oh no, cried Earl Marshal, such things can never be. For if the queen should get word of this, then hang it, I would be. I swear by the sun, I swear by the moon, and by the stars on high, and by my scepter and my crown, Earl Marshal shall not die. So the king put on a grey friar's gown, and the earl put on another, and they are gone to fair London town, like friars both together. And when they came before the queen, they fell on bended knee. What matter, our gracious queen, you've called so speedily? Oh, if you are 2 friars of France, it's you I wish to see. But if you are 2 English lords, then hanged you shall be. Oh, we are not 2 English lords, but friars both are we. vile sin I did commit, I now will tell to thee. I fell in love with the Earl Marshal as he brought me o'er the sea. Oh, that was a vile sin, said the king. May God forgive it thee. Amen, amen, said the Earl Marshal, with a heavy heart spake he. Oh, the next vile sin I did commit, I will to you unfold. Earl Marshal had my virgin dower beneath this gown of gold. Oh, that was a vile sin, said the king. May God forgive it thee. Amen, amen, said the Earl Marshal, for a frightened man was he. Oh, don't you see to yonder little boys a playing at the ball? Oh, that one is Earl Marshal's son, and I like him the best of all. Oh, don't you see yonder little boy a playing at the ball? Oh, that one is King Henry's son, and I like him the worst of all. His head is like a blind bull's head, his feet are like a bear. What matter, what matter, cried the king, he's my son and my only heir. And the king pulled off his grey friar's thong and stood in his scarlet so red. Queen Eleanor turned in her bed and cried that she was betrayed. And the king looked o'er his left shoulder, and a grim look at he. Oh, Earl Marshal, but for my oath, then a hanged you would be. Turkey rhubarb, turkey rhubarb, turkey rhubarb, I sell. I come here from Turkey to make you all well. Don't you all know me, all me name it is Dan, for I am the celebrated Turkey Rhubarb man.
Turkey rhubarb, turkey rhubarb, turkey rhubarb I sell.
I come here from Turkey to make you all well. Don't you all know me, all me name it is Dan, for I am the celebrated Turkey Rhubarb Man.
As I walked out one May morning, down by come around. rein, pardon, pardon me in calling you bold fisherman come rolling down the sea. He took her by the lily white hand, saying, proud Margaret stood at her father's doorway, as straight as a willow wand, and by there came a gardener bold, with a red rose in his hand, with a red rose in his hand. Oh, you shall have my rose, fair maiden, if you give your flower to me, and among the flowers in your father's garden, I'll make a gown for thee, for thee. I'll make a gown for thee. Your gown shall be sweet smelling thyme, your apron celandine, your petticoat of the chamomile. Come and kiss sweetheart and join and join. Come kiss sweetheart and join. Your gloves shall be of the clover and flower, your shoes of the rue so fine, I'll line them with the cornflower blue. So join your love with mine, with mine. So join your love with mine. Since you have made a gown for me among the summer flowers, so I will make a suit for thee among the winter showers, the showers, among the winter showers. The milk that lies your body next, and the night black rain will be your coat. With the wind go like your breast, your breast. With the wind go like your breast. The horse
hi, welcome back to the Moorish Orthodox Rite Crusade. That was Queen Eleanor's Confession, Turkey Rhubarb, Bold Fisherman, and The Gardener off a wonderful record by Tim Hart and Mattie Pryor called Folk Songs of Old England. This is Volume 2. And I believe it's still in print. I have this on a CD. I'm still available on a CD. And you're listening to WBAI here in New York, and I am going to continue my series of readings on magical little events and talking to the animals and not talking to the animals, snakes and birds and such. And we started out with Gibbon Sorrentino and some sort of classic European fairy tales from Andrew Lang's Green Fairy Book, and now I'm going to follow with one admirer of Andrew Lang's fairy books, anyway. That's not just something I think, it's something I know from a much more, in some ways, a much more famous writer. Certainly more, not a more influential writer, really, but someone that's probably more likely to have read. P.L. Travers, who wrote the Mary Poppins book, and this is from the second in that series called Mary Poppins Comes Back. And this is the chapter in that book called The New One. "But why must we go for a walk with Ellen?" grumbled Michael, slamming the gate. "I don't like her. Her nose is too red." "Shh," said Jane. "She'll hear you." Ellen, who was wheeling the perambulator, turned around. "You're a cruel, unkind boy, Master Michael. I'm only doing my duty, I'm sure. It's no pleasure to me to be going for a walk in this heat. So there." She blew her red nose into a green handkerchief. "Then why do you go?" Michael demanded. "Guess Mary Poppins is busy, so come along, there's a good boy, and I'll buy you a penn'orth of peppermints." "I don't want peppermints," muttered Michael. "I want Mary Poppins." Plop, 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 plop. Ellen's feet marched slowly and heavily along the lane. "I can see a rainbow through every chink of my hat," said Jane. "I can't," said Michael crossly. "I can only see my silk lining." Ellen stopped at the corner, looking anxiously for traffic. "Want any help?" inquired the policeman, sauntering up to her. "Well," said Ellen, blushing, "if you could take me across the road, I'd be much obliged. What with a bad cold and four children to look after, I don't know if I'm on my head or my feet." She blew her nose again. "But you must know, you've only got to look," said Michael, thinking how perfectly awful Ellen was. But the policeman apparently thought differently, for he took Ellen's arm with one hand, the handle of the perambulator with the other, and led her across the street as tenderly as though she were a bride. "Ever get a day off?" he inquired, looking interestedly into Ellen's red face. "Well," said Ellen, "half days, so to speak. Every second Saturday." She blew her nose nervously. "Funny," said the policeman, "those are my days, too. And I'm usually just around here at 2 o'clock in the afternoon." "Oh," said Ellen, opening her mouth very wide. "So," said the policeman, nodding at her politely. "Well, I'll see," said Ellen. "Goodbye." And she went trudging on, looking back occasionally to see if the policeman was still looking. And he always was. "Mary Poppins never needs a policeman," complained Michael. "What can she be busy about?" "Something important is happening at home," said Jane. "I'm sure of it." "How do you know?" "I've got an empty, waiting sort of feeling inside." "Pooh," said Michael, "I expect you're hungry. Can't we go faster, Ellen, and get it over with?" "That boy," said Ellen to the park railing, "has a beautiful home." "No, we can't, Master Michael, because of my feet." "What's the matter with them?" "They will only go so fast and no faster." "Oh, dear, Mary Poppins," said Michael bitterly. He went sighing after the perambulator. Jane walked beside him, counting rainbows through her hat. Ellen's slow feet tramped steadily onward. One, two, plop, 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 and away behind them at Cherry Lane, the important thing was happening. From the outside, number 17 looked as peaceful and sleepy as all the other houses, but behind the drawn blinds there was such a stir and bustle that if it hadn't been summertime, a passerby might have thought that the people in the house were spring cleaning or getting ready for Christmas. But the house itself stood blinking in the sunshine, taking no notice. "After all," it thought to itself, "I have seen such houses often before, and I shall probably see them many times again, so why should I bother about it?" And just then the front door was flung open by Mrs. Burrell, and Dr. Simpson hurried out. Mrs. Brill stood dancing on her toes as she watched him go down the garden path, swinging his little brown bag. Then she hurried to the pantry and called excitedly, "Where are you, Robertson? Come along if you're coming." She scuttled up the stairs two at a time with Robertson A. yawning and stretching behind her. "Shh," hissed Mrs. Brill. "Shh." She put her finger up to her lips and tiptoed to Mrs. Banks's door. "I can't see nothing but the wardrobe," she complained as she bent to look through the keyhole. "The wardrobe and a bit of the winder." But the next moment she started violently. "Oh, my glory goodness!" she shrieked as the door burst open suddenly, and she fell back across Robertson A. But there, framed against the light, stood Mary Poppins, looking very stern and suspicious. In her arms she carried with great care something that looked like a bundle of blankets. "Well," said Mrs. Brill breathlessly, "if it isn't you. I was just polishing the doorknob, putting a shine on it, as you say, as you come out." Mary Poppins looked at the knob. It was very dirty. "Polishing the keyhole is what I should have said," she remarked tartly. But Mrs. Brill took no notice. She was gazing tenderly at the bundle. With her large red hand, she drew aside a fold of one of the blankets, and a satisfied smile spread over her face. "Ah," she cooed, "ah, the lamb, ah, the duck, ah, the trinket, and as good as a week of Sundays, I'll be bound." Robertson A. yawned again and stared at the bundle with his mouth slightly open. "Another pair of shoes to clean," he said mournfully, leaning against the banisters for support. "Mind you don't drop it now," said Mrs. Brill, anxiously, as Mary Poppins brushed past her. Mary Poppins glared at them both contemptuously. "If I were some people," she remarked acidly, "I'd mind my own business." And then she folded the blanket over the bundle again and went upstairs to the nursery. "Excuse me, please, excuse me." Mr. Banks came rushing up the stairs, nearly knocking Mrs. Brill over as he hurried into Mrs. Banks' bedroom. "Well," he said, sitting down at the foot of the bed, "this is all very awkward indeed. I don't know that I can afford it. I hadn't bargained for 5. "I'm so sorry," said Mrs. Banks, smiling at him happily. "You're not sorry, not a bit. In fact, you're very pleased and conceited about it. And there's no reason to be. It's a very small one." "I like them that way," said Mrs. Banks. "Besides, it will grow." "Yes, unfortunately," he replied bitterly, "and I shall have to buy it shoes and clothes and a tricycle, yes, and send it to school and give it a good start in life, a very expensive proceeding. And then, after all that, when I'm old and sitting by the fire, it will go away and leave me. You hadn't thought of that, I suppose." "No," said Mrs. Banks, trying to look sorry but not succeeding. "I hadn't." "I thought not. Well, there it is. But I warn you, I shall not be able to afford to have the bathroom retiled." "Don't worry about that," said Mrs. Banks comfortingly. "I really like the old tiles best." "Then you're a very stupid woman. That's all I have to say." And Mr. Banks went away, muttering and blustering through the house. But when he got outside the front door, he flung back his shoulders and pushed out his chest and put a large cigar into his mouth. And soon after that, he was heard telling Admiral Boom the news in a voice that was very loud and conceited and boastful. Mary Poppins stooped over the new cradle between John's and Barbara's cots and laid the bundle of blankets carefully into it. "Here you are at last, bless my beak and tall and tail feathers. I thought you were never coming." "Which is it?" cried a croaking voice from the window. Mary Poppins looked up. The starling who lived at the top of the chimney was hopping excitedly on the windowsill. "A girl, Annabel," said Mary Poppins shortly. "And I'll thank you to be a little quieter, squawking and cackling there like a packet of magpies." But the starling was not listening. He was turning somersaults on the windowsill, clapping his wings wildly together each time his head came up. "What a treat!" he panted when at last he stood up straight. "What a treat! Oh, I could sing!" "You couldn't. Not if you tried till doomsday," scoffed Mary Poppins. But the starling was too happy to care. "A girl!" he shrieked, dancing on his toes. "I've had 3 broods this season, and would you believe it, every one of them boys. But Annabel will make up to me for that." He hopped a little along the sill. "Annabel," he burst out again. "That's a nice name. I had an Aunt Annabel. Used to live in Admiral Boom's chimney and died, poor thing, of eating green apples and grapes. I warned her, but she wouldn't believe me, so of course." "Will you be quiet?" demanded Mary Poppins, making a dive at him with her apron. "I will not," he shouted, dodging neatly. "This is no time for silence. I'm going to spread the news." He swooped out of the window. "Back in 5 minutes," he screamed at her over his shoulder as he darted away. Mary Poppins moved quietly about the nursery, putting Annabelle's new clothes into a neat pile. The sunlight slipping in at the window crept across the room and up to the cradle. "Open your eyes," it said softly, "and I'll put a shine on them." The coverlet of the cradle trembled. Annabelle opened her eyes. "Good girl," said the sunlight. "They're blue, I see, my favorite color. There. You won't find a brighter pair of eyes anywhere." It slipped lightly out of Annabelle's eyes and down the side of the cradle. "Thank you very much," said Annabelle, politely. A warm breeze stirred the muslin flounce at her head. "Curls or straight?" it whispered, dropping into the cradle beside her. "Oh, curls, please," said Annabelle softly. "It does save trouble, doesn't it?" agreed the breeze, and it moved over her head, carefully turning up the feathery edges of her hair before it flitted off across the room.
Here we are.
A harsh voice shrilled from the window. The starling had returned to the sill, and behind him, wobbling uncertainly as he alighted, came a very young bird. Mary Poppins moved toward them threateningly. "Now you be off," she said angrily. "I'll have no sparrows littering up this nursery." But the starling, with the young one at his side, brushed haughtily past her.
"Kindly remember, Mary Poppins," he said icily, "that all my families are properly brought up. Littering, indeed."
He lighted neatly on the edge of the cradle and steadied the fledgling beside him. The young bird stared about him with round, inquisitive eyes. The starling hopped along to the pillow.
"Annabelle, dear," he began in a husky, wheedling voice, "I'm very partial to a nice, crisp, crunchy piece of arrowroot biscuit." His eyes twinkled greedily. "You haven't one about you, I suppose?"
The curled head stirred on the pillow.
"No, well, you're young yet for biscuits, perhaps. Your sister Barbara, nice girl she was, very generous and pleasant, always remembered me. So, if in the future you could spare the old fellow a crumb or two."
"Of course I will," said Annabelle from the folds of the blanket.
"Good girl," croaked the starling approvingly.
He cocked his head on one side and gazed at her with his round, bright eye.
"I hope," he remarked politely, "you are not too tired after your journey."
Annabelle shook her head.
"Where has she come from? Out of an egg?" chirped the fledgling suddenly.
"Huh," scoffed Mary Poppins. "Do you think she's a sparrow?" The starling gave her a pained and haughty look.
"Well, what is she then, and where did she come from?"
cried the fledgling shrilly, flapping his short wings and staring down into the cradle.
"You tell him, Annabelle," the starling croaked.
Annabelle moved her hands inside the blanket. "I am earth and air and fire and water," she said softly. "I come from the dark where all things have their beginning."
"Ah, such dark," said the starling softly, bending his head on his breast.
"It was dark in the egg, too," the fledgling cheeped.
"I come from the sea and its tides," Annabelle went on. "I come from the sky and its stars. I come from the sun and its brightness."
"Ah, so bright," said the starling, nodding.
"And I come from the forests of earth." As if in a dream, Mary Poppins rocked the cradle to and fro, with a steady, swinging movement.
"Yes," whispered the fledgling.
"Slowly I moved at first," said Annabelle, "always sleeping and dreaming. I remembered all I had been, and I thought of all I shall be. And when I dream my dream, I awoke and came swiftly." She paused for a moment, her blue eyes full of memories.
"And then?" prompted the fledgling.
"I heard the stars singing as I came, and I felt warm wings about me. I passed the beasts of the jungle and came through the deep, dark waters. It was a long journey." Annabelle was silent. The fledgling stared at her with his bright, inquisitive eyes. Mary Poppins' hand lay quietly on the side of the cradle. She had stopped rocking.
"A long journey indeed," said the starling softly, lifting his head from his breast. "And, so soon forgotten?"
Annabelle stirred under the quilt.
"No," she said confidently, "I'll never forget."
"Stuff and nonsense, beaks and claws, of course you will. By the time the week's out, you won't remember a word of it, what you are or where you came from."
Inside her flannel petticoat, Annabelle was kicking furiously. I will,
how could I forget?" "Because they all do," jeered the starling harshly. "Every silly human except,"
he nodded his head at Mary Poppins,
"her. She's different. She's the oddity. She's the misfit."
"You sparrow!" cried Mary Poppins, making a dart at him.
But with a rude laugh, he swept his fledgling off the edge of the cradle and flew with him to the window sill. "Touch you last," he said cheekily as he brushed out. "Hello, what's that?" There was a chorus of voices outside the landing and a clatter of feet on the stairs. "I don't believe you! I won't believe you!" cried Annabel wildly. And at that moment, Jane and Michael and the twins burst into the room. "Mrs. Brill says you've got something to show us," said Jane, flinging off her hat. "What is it?" demanded Michael, gazing around the room. "Show me! Me too!" shrieked the twins. Mary Poppins glared at them. "Is this a decent nursery or the zoological gardens?" she inquired angrily. "Answer me that!" "The zoo or..." Michael broke off weakly, for he had caught Mary Poppins' eye. "I mean a nursery," he said hurriedly. "Oh, look, Michael, look," Jane said excitedly. "I told you something important was happening. It's a new baby. Oh, Mary Poppins, can I have it to keep?" Mary Poppins, with a furious glance at them all, stopped and lifted Annabel out of the cradle and sat down with her in the old armchair. "Gently, please, gently," she warned as they crowded around her. "This is a baby, not a battleship." "A boy baby?" asked Michael. "No, a girl, Annabel." Michael and Annabel stared at each other. He put his finger into her hand, and she clutched it tightly. "My doll," said John, pushing up against Mary Poppins' knee. "My rabbit," said Barbara, tugging at Annabel's shawl. "Oh," breathed Jane, touching the hair that the wind had curled. "How very small and sweet, like a star. Where did you come from, Annabel?" Very pleased to be asked, Annabel began her story again. "I came from the dark," she recited softly. Jane laughed. "Such funny little sounds," she cried. "I wish she could talk and tell us." Annabel stared. "But I am telling you," she protested, kicking. "Ha ha!" shrieked the starling rudely from the window. "What did I say? Excuse me laughing." The fledgling giggled behind his wing. "Perhaps she came from a toy shop," said Michael. Annabel, with a furious movement, flung his finger from her. "Don't be silly," said Jane. "Dr. Simpson must have brought her in his little brown bag." "Was I right or was I wrong?" The starling's old dark eyes gleamed tauntingly at Annabel. "Tell me that," he jeered, flapping his wings in triumph. But for answer, Annabel turned her face against Mary Poppins' apron and wept. Her first cries, thin and lonely, rang piercingly through the house. "There, there," said the starling gruffly. "Don't take on. It can't be helped. You're only a human child, after all. But next time, perhaps you'll believe your betters, elders and betters, elders and betters," he screamed, prancing conceitedly up and down. "Michael, take my feather duster, please, and sweep them birds off the sill," said Mary Poppins ominously. A squawk of amusement came from the starling. "We can sweep ourselves off, Mary Poppins. Thank you. We were just going anyway. Come along, boy." And with a loud, clacking chuckle, he flicked the fledgling over the sill and swooped with him through the window. In a very short time, Annabel settled down comfortably to life in Cherry Tree Lane. She enjoyed being the center of attention and was always pleased when somebody leant over her cradle and told her how pretty she was, or how good, or how sweet-tempered. "Do go on admiring me," she would say, smiling. "I like it so much." And then they would hasten to tell her how curly her hair was or how blue her eyes, and Annabel would smile in such a satisfied way that they would say, "How intelligent she is! You would almost think she understood." But that always annoyed her, and then she would turn away in disgust at their foolishness, which was silly, because when she was disgusted, she looked so charming that then became more foolish than ever. She was a week old before the starling returned. Mary Poppins, in the dim glow of the nightlight, was gently rocking the cradle when he appeared. "Back again?" snapped Mary Poppins, watching him prance in. "You're as bad as a bad penny." She gave a long, disgusted sniff.
"I've been busy," said the starling. "Have to keep my affairs in order. This isn't the only nursery I have to look in after, you know."
His beady black eyes twinkled wickedly. She said shortly. "I'm sorry for the others." He chuckled and shook his head.
"Nobody like her," he remarked cheerfully to the blind tassel. "Nobody like her. She's got an answer for everything."
He cocked his head towards the cradle.
"Well, how are things, Annabel asleep?"
"No thanks to you if she is," said Mary Poppins. The starling ignored the remark. He hopped to the end of the sill.
"I'll keep watch," he said in a whisper. "You go down and get a cup of tea."
Mary Poppins stood up. "Mind you don't wake her then." The starling laughed pityingly.
My dear girl, I have in my time brought up at least 20 broods of fledglings. I don't need to be told how to look after a mere baby.
Mary Poppins walked to the cupboard and very pointedly put the biscuit tin under her arm before she went downstairs and shut the door. The starling mushed up and down the window sill backwards and forwards with his wingtips under his tail feathers. There was a small stir in the cradle. Annabelle opened her eyes.
"Hello," she said. "I was waiting to see you."
"Ha!" said the starling, swooping towards her.
"There's something I wanted to remember," said Annabelle, frowning, "and I thought you might remind me."
He started. His dark eyes glittered.
"How does it go?" he said softly. "Like this?"
And he began in a husky whisper.
"I am earth and air and fire and water."
"No, no," said Annabelle impatiently. "Of course it doesn't."
"Well," said the starling anxiously, "was it about your journey? You came from the sea and its tides. You came from the sky and..."
"Oh, don't be so silly," said Annabelle. "The only journey I ever took was to the park and back again this morning. No, no, it was something important, something beginning with B." She crowed suddenly.
"I've got it," she cried. "It's biscuit, half an arrowroot biscuit on the mantelpiece. Michael left it there after tea." "Is that all?"
said the starling sadly.
"Yes, of course," Annabelle said fretfully. "Isn't it enough? I thought you'd be glad of a nice piece of biscuit."
So I am," said the starling hastily. "But..." She turned her head on the pillow and closed her eyes.
"Don't talk any more now, please," she said. "I want to go to sleep."
The starling glanced across at the mantelpiece and down again at Annabelle.
"Biscuits," he said, shaking his head. "Alas, Annabelle, alas."
Mary Poppins came in quietly and closed the door.
"Did she wake?" she said in a whisper. The starling nodded. "Only for a minute," he said sadly, "but it was long enough."
Mary Poppins' eyes questioned him.
"She's forgotten," he said with a catch in his croak. "She's forgotten it all. I knew she would, but, oh, my dear, what a pity."
Mary Poppins moved quietly about the nursery, putting the toys away. She glanced at the starling. He was standing on the windowsill with his back to her, and his speckled shoulders were heaving. "Caught another cold?" she remarked sarcastically. He wheeled around.
"Certainly not. It's the night air. Rather chilly, you know, makes the eyes water. Well, I must be off."
He waddled unsteadily to the edge of the sill.
"I'm getting old," he croaked sadly. "That's what it is. Not so young as we were, eh, Mary Poppins?"
"I don't know about you," Mary Poppins drew herself up haughtily, "but I'm quite as young as I was, thank you."
"Ah," said the starling, shaking his head, "you're the wonder, an absolute marvelous, wonderful wonder."
His round eyes twinkled wickedly.
"I don't think," he called back rudely as he dived out the window.
"Impudent sparrow," she shouted after him, and shut the window with a bang.
Young women, they run like hares on the mountains. Young women, they run like hares on the mountains. And if I was a young man, I'd soon go a-hunting to be right for the diddle thereof, right for the diddle day. Young women, they sing like birds in the bushes. Young women, they sing like birds in the bushes. If I was a young man, I'd go beat them bushes. And me right follow diddle there, right follow diddle day. Young women, they swim like ducks in the water. Young women, they swim like ducks in the water. If I was a young man, I'd soon
swimming, they run like hares on the mountains. Young women, they run like hares on the mountains. And if I was a young man, I'd soon go a-hunting. To me, right for the diddle day, right for the diddle day.
That was Hares on the Mountain, a traditional English song done by Steel Ice Band. And this has been the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. We're done for this week, and I'll be here next week again. And please do stay tuned for Tom Whisker and Weaponry. You're listening to WBAI in New York City.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.